Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. In the 2013 Action Report, more than three-quarters of the people interviewed in San Luis Obispo County were concerned about drug, tobacco, and alcohol abuse. Most of these groups of drugs rate opiate addiction across the nation are increasing at alarming rates. A report by San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services suggested that deaths associated with this type of drug use have now bypassed those associated with alcohol, and the trend is on the increase. Today, I'll be talking with local professionals in the field of addiction medicine about how the community is addressing this dangerous trend and where individuals and families can get help. A little later in the show, we'll hear from the perspective of three individuals who are dealing with opiate addiction, someone who's in recovery, an individual who's graduated from a program, and a mom supporting her son's struggle. I'm joined in the first half hour of today's program by Dr. Ken Starr of the Addiction Medicine Group, Dr. Star Graber, Division Manager, and Katie Dolezal. Is it Dolezal?
Dolezal.
Dolezal, nurse practitioner from San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services, to discuss the serious issue. As always, you are part of the show, and you can bring your voice to our conversation by calling us at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875, and bring your observations or questions. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
So when we're talking, let's start with you, Dr. Graber, to talk a little bit about, in 2013, there was a report from the county that went out about the need for detoxification here in San Luis Obispo County. You want to talk a little bit about why that even came about?
Sure. The report is on the website, and so it talks about different drugs, and there is a feeling that there's no options for detoxification in the county. And so the outpatient detox and private physicians are doing detoxification. I wanted to get that point out, that there are options.
And we have one
options.
Of them here.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right.
And so that there are options in the county. Now, we still need some more work, and so there is a proposal before the Board of Supervisors coming up to create an expanded detoxification team for the county. So we're looking forward to that, and certainly Katie and I can talk about that piece because that will really help families who are more in crisis about this and increase the access.
When we talk about what is, you know, what kind of issues there are and the increase that's happened, can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing, either Katie or
I'll just do the statistics first.
Sure.
And then someone else can address the more practical level. In our county, we have been monitoring this trend, and we noticed the spike back in 2010. It started going up at that point, the admission rates to treatment associated with opiates. At this point, we just ran the figures this week about opiate admissions into treatment, and now the opiate rate is the number two position and barely surpassing, it has now surpassed marijuana and alcohol. So methamphetamine is still number one, but our heroin addiction, opiate addiction is right there, right neck and neck, and actually it's been a 74% increase in the last 4 years.
My goodness. It's incredible. That is
incredible.
And would you please kind of expand on when you're talking about opiate addiction, what are you talking about? What kinds of drugs are you talking about?
Well, generally we have different classifications. We have heroin, and then the prescription medications. Some of those may be morphine,
Norco,
Vicodin, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some other prescription pain medication drugs that are opiate-based, and those are also contributing to this phenomenal right now.
Okay. And Dr. Starr, from an emergency room physician standpoint, this is something that you probably encountered throughout your career of drug use in the ER.
Yes, exactly. Everybody
with an opiate addiction will at some point end up in the ER.
Okay. For one reason
for
another.
Overdose, for an infection, for a medication side effect.
And you've been
for drug seeking, for something.
Just for something. And you've been in San Luis County now for how long?
Just 3 years.
Okay. And have you noticed a difference in that 3 years?
Well, I came down here from Oregon.
Okay.
So I don't think, and so it's a much smaller community than where I was practicing. So I didn't see an alarming increase in opiate use. But as a practitioner of emergency medicine full time, it's a common theme during any shift is seeing complications, side effects, or a visit related to opiate dependence or opiate abuse.
Katie, when you know, you're as a nurse practitioner who's involved with drug and alcohol services, what is your role?
Well, at this point, I run the Suboxone Detox Program for our county, which we treat people with opiate addiction, heroin, OxyContin, Dilaudid, Norco, anything opiate-based that is not prescribed. So there's
Could be prescription medications. It's not prescribed to them.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, they're getting it from somewhere.
Okay.
Someplace.
Okay.
I help them withdraw from their opiate using a medication called Suboxone. So Suboxone is an opiate itself, and we take that addiction, we put them on Suboxone so they're comfortable and can manage their withdrawal symptoms, because oftentimes people are caught in this circle for many other reasons. But in addition, it has to do with the physical dependence that's sort of unique to opiate withdrawal. And so not only are there other reasons, but they become physically dependent, and when they stop, they're ill. And so my role is to help ease those physical withdrawal symptoms while at the same time adding treatment, so that when all the opiate Suboxone is gone, they'll have a structure with which to make other choices and have support, so that they, you know, hopefully won't go back.
And how long has the county had that program in operation?
Well, I've been in addiction medicine since 1995.
Okay.
When I came on, we had a not particularly successful detox program, but the best we had at the time. So from 95 to 2001, we did have an opiate detox, okay? And then I left for a little while. Suboxone came on the market in 2004, and in 2007, we opened our doors using this new medication. So since then.
Has there been a change, Dr. Graber, in San Luis County residents' recognition that this is a problem? Do you think this is widely enough known and recognized as an issue and a concern?
I do, and it's starting to become. There's other forces. Law enforcement, for example, recently has been talking about it. The number of arrests that appear to be under the influence of heroin distribution in our county. So there is starting to be that awareness. And folks, the statistics that I talked about were for folks coming into treatment. And so they're coming into treatment with those issues, which is a good thing.
But that doesn't speak to the people that are not coming into treatment.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And Dr. Starr, when you see individuals in emergency room, are we talking about one particular age group? Are you seeing diversity there?
I think opiate dependence doesn't really discriminate based on age. And you probably have to separate opiate dependence from opiate addiction.
Can you talk about that, please?
Well, so there's people who are opiate dependent who've been taking pain medicines a long time as prescribed by their physician for medical indications, who after a period of time, maybe those doses have creeped up and up and up, and then they'll become a slave to the medicine. And then sometimes people have a realization like, wow, my pain is maybe better, maybe it's not, I don't really know, but now I'm a slave to these medicines because if I don't take it, I'm going to get
right.
sick. They've never misused the medicines. They've never used them illicitly. They're not addicted because they don't have any aberrant behavior associated with that use. Then we have just opiate addiction, where people like use more than they should, use medicines that are not prescribed. But the age, all comers, teenagers, older folks, anybody, really, it doesn't discriminate.
Is there an upsurge, do you think, in young people who are using heroin in this county?
Yes.
You're nodding your head.
Yes, yes, we're seeing that. For example, one of the common primary drugs in that age group was marijuana, and it's switching now. And it really is. We're seeing more and more folks coming in with opiate-based addiction problems.
I can comment on that. When I was in the detox program for opiates in my first, 95 to 2001, I'd say my average age was maybe 38. And now I think it's probably mid-20s. I've seen people as young as 16 and 17 coming in because they are, in that spiral of the opiate dependence and addiction.
And so in their 20s, they've been involved with the drug for a period of years by the time you're seeing them.
Right. Very rarely do people come in for treatment unless they've been doing it for a while.
And we have
it happens.
We have teenagers in our
in your program.
Yeah.
And Dr. Starr, talk about the program that you have.
Well, so about almost 3 years ago, I started just prescribing, as Katie had mentioned, Suboxone, because I thought there was a need for it. And then my practice grew as I brought on drug and alcohol counselors and offered more clinical services. And so what we do is we do an assessment for people who come in with opiate and alcohol dependence, but we're talking mostly about opiates now, and offer outpatient detox primarily. You get them medically stabilized, and then provide a structure for counseling support. So we try to do it as an outpatient. We don't offer, we're not associated with any inpatient use right now, inpatient facilities. But and most people with opiate dependence are fine as the outpatient, as long as they're not a lot of other co-occurring medications or underlying psychiatric problems. If it's just opiate dependence, most of those folks do fine. So, medically stabilize them with a number of medicines, one of which is Suboxone, but there's others. Or just offer detox and then, counseling groups, individual therapy, intensive outpatient program, depending on what level of care they need, we can offer.
Okay. Years ago, I actually moved into this county in 1978, and my husband at the time came to Santa Barbara County to run a methadone maintenance program. Mm-hmm. And at the time that he was running the methadone maintenance program, a good percentage of his clients were from San Luis Obispo County. There was no maintenance program in San Luis Obispo County, and this county didn't recognize that heroin addiction was an issue. In fact, law enforcement and individuals in the county were saying, we don't have an issue here. Mm-hmm. It's based in Santa Barbara County, which is why we don't address it. Mm-hmm. So, things have changed, which is really nice to see.
Right. Yep. And we do have the methadone clinic now in Atascadero. So I want to put out a notice that for opiate addiction over long term, methadone maintenance is still viable for some clients and needed. And so the Aegis Medical Clinic up in Atascadero is a resource there.
Okay. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 in San Luis Obispo, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org, part of the NPR Digital Network. The voices you hear with me right now are Dr. Ken Starr of Addiction Medicine Group, Dr. Starr Graber, Division Manager, and Katie Dolezal, Nurse Practitioner from San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services. We're talking about opiate abuse, addiction, misuse, and mortality. We're going to be talking a little bit about and the growing concern in emergency rooms, both nationally, but also specifically locally. Central Coast Voices is a participatory show, and we invite your questions, observations, and comments. So please feel free to bring your conversation to our discussion today by calling 781-3875. That's 781-3875. What, Dr. Graber, do you think is one of the biggest myths that you come across or distortions of truth that you think exists right now in dealing with some of the issues that you're trying to address?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first one is that there's no detox services available or that you need a residential facility to do that. And as Dr. Starr had said, that opiate detoxification can be done on an outpatient basis, and the next thing is to associate a treatment program with that process.
Okay. And how about for you, Dr. Starr? Myths or misconceptions that you run into?
I think in my practice, the biggest misconception is that opiate dependence is a moral failing. It's a weak character.
Yeah.
You need to just pull it together and get your life together and make some right decisions. Where in reality, and it's a chronic disease. I mean, you wouldn't tell somebody with a sugar of 800 or extremely high blood sugar, just pull it together and lower your blood sugar.
Right.
And you wouldn't throw somebody in a 30-day treatment program for their high blood pressure. You know, it's a chronic relapsing brain disease that is managed that way. So a lot of people can't understand that. Well, it's not just a moral failing of stupidity and ill repute. It's really...
Or bad upbringing or a broken family.
Exactly. And it's a family disease, too.
Oh.
So it's a very important, when we have treatment, you know, the folks who do well in treatment are ones who have support from their family. And it's treated like a medical disease with frequent monitoring and follow-up and support and checking in.
We had somebody who called in who said, can you discuss mothers that use, how it affects the family, also how it affects children in the womb, then born with addiction and dependence? Is this prevalent in our county? I'll put that out to...
Yes, it is. I mean, neonatal withdrawal syndrome is a very real condition. My wife's an NICU nurse, and there's babies withdrawing from opiates when they're born in the neonatal intensive care at the hospitals locally. And that's not pleasant to watch. Those babies are screaming in pain, and it's, you know, it's terrible.
And the effect on the whole family. I mean, with moms who use, the idea that it's just young people or it's just people who are operating independently who don't have families who count on them. That's probably not the average client that you're seeing,
right,
or you guys, right, Katie?
Mm-hmm. In San Luis Obispo County, in my detox program, I certainly wish there was more family support. I invite it. I encourage it. What I found in sort of my clinical practice is by the time someone is that far down in their addiction, there's many bridges. We call, you know, bridges that have been burned. And though family support for a lot of people is, you know, paramount to their success, there's been a lot of alienation by the time, you know, you reach that physical dependence, because there's lots of choices that have been made along the way that are not conducive to good family relations.
Right, and very hurtful, I would think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How about for you, Dr. Starr, in your program? The families, do you see individuals with families, and is there family support?
There can be. You know, our clinic has a free Sunday meeting every week that's just for families and family support for patients in our program and patients not in the program. And the girls, we have three drug and alcohol counselors now at our office who are amazing. And, you know, part of their treatment plan is certainly to involve families. But as Katie mentioned, you know, it takes, there's behaviors that have had to develop, that have developed to be a successful opiate addict over years that are isolating and untruthful.
Right.
So it's
so it breaks relationships.
You're right.
I want to go back to that first question you asked us about the myths.
Yeah.
One, I have two, but one I want to address in this context is that the thought that you can do this alone. This meaning recovery from this extensive of an addiction.
Right.
That, you know, the NA meeting, you know, no one's an island. You need people around you supporting you.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you hide your addiction, you're continuing some of those behaviors even if you're clean. So we need each other.
Okay. And we have a call from Bob. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You have a question or comment, sir?
Yeah, I wanted to find out how much culpability do you think current medical practices have in creating this problem in the first place?
In terms of the dependence on the medications?
By the very fact that most people, I mean, what I would say is we are a drug-taking nation, and most people that are prescribed drugs are prescribed some form of pain medication. So we have a situation where we're actually seeing like we're creating the problem. We're trying to fix somewhere down the road and then putting it on the families as if they were really wanting this in the first place, or they were driven towards this, or whatever, however you want to describe it. Because there are so many other options to look at in terms of dealing with pain than just prescribing opiates.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Bob. We'll have our panel address that. Dr. Starr, do you want to start as a medical?
So, absolutely. So Bob made a very good point. You have to know historically some legislative changes that occurred in this country over the last 15 years. And to summarize it, the feds and the state made pain the fifth vital sign. And this was, in part related to drug company funding and some other things that went on. But, physicians were being prosecuted and disciplined for under-prescribing pain medicines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, pain became the fifth vital sign in the ER. What's your pain score? What's going on? So there was this big push that physicians need to treat pain. We're under-treating pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 180 degrees. Now we have a public health epidemic of opiate prescription abuse and misuse. Physicians have over-prescribed drugs. There are certain drugs that physicians, when drugs came on the market, they told physicians these weren't even narcotics or that caused dependence, like tramadol, mm-hmm. which was just false. So now it's turned the other way. So Bob's exactly right. Physicians have, very leniently prescribed opiates. And the tides are turning now. Different formulations, stricter guidelines, which unfortunately has now made heroin cheaper and more accessible because pain pills are harder to get and more expensive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, physicians assume a lot of culpability. The medical industrial complex is absolutely responsible. Chronic pain services and very lenient prescribing habits have created a lot of opiate dependence in our community and our country.
Thanks for calling in, Bob.
Thank you.
So with that, is it something that you're seeing now? I mean, what happens to the individuals that are kind of stuck, as you described, the people that are dependent on
medications? So there are a couple things. What happens now, primary care physicians, internists, don't want to be the prescribers of opiates. If you need to be on pain medicine now, you have to go see a chronic pain doc. That's their party line. If you need to be on more than a certain amount of pain medicine a month, you need to see a pain specialist. And they can kind of isolate themselves out of it and shoulder the responsibility of somebody else. And that just and chronic pain docs oftentimes, just increase pain medicines.
Right.
On the other hand, in the emergency room specifically, we've changed our practices a lot. We've identified overutilizers of the ER for frequent pain visits and, appropriately, cautiously, and very compassionately referred them to other resources. We've limited the amount of pain medicine that can be prescribed in an ER visit. And that's some guidelines that have come down from other states like Washington and Oregon, where you don't leave that where long-acting pain medicines aren't prescribed in the ER. Pain lost and prescriptions for refills aren't refilled in the ER. And even for an acute injury, you usually don't get more than a few days of pain medicine now in an ER. All to just kind of be mindful of abuse and misuse.
You mentioned something that I have heard from a number of other sources too, and that is that with this trend change, what has happened is that prescription meds that are sold on a black market, if you will, are much more expensive now than heroin. Heroin is more easily accessible, available, and cheaper. And so people are using it more freely. And we're seeing, certainly high-profile cases in Hollywood that have had heroin overdoses. We see it locally with individuals who are young and older. And is that a problem in this community here?
It is. It's a huge problem in this community. Mm-hmm. We have teenagers who initially either get on pain medicines for an injury or a surgery, or they get it out of their parents' medicine cabinet. They develop a habit. They can't afford the habit, and they find that using heroin is a lot less expensive and easier to do.
And I want to also ask, too, that the image of somebody who uses heroin of being a junkie who's injecting themselves, multiple times during the day, is that a true image?
Well, that's
is
true,
that,
but there's a lot.
Is that the only?
No. I mean, we have high functioning successful professional people in our community who are smoking OxyContin pills every 2 hours and burn through $5,000 a month spent, you know, on habits like that. And they may not be, you know, using heroin intravenously, but they have a very serious opiate habit. So it might include smoking medicines. It might include injecting. But no, it's all ages. It's not just the Vietnam vet on the street in a green jacket and a skateboard. I mean, it's not that characteristic.
And it's
all
not somebody walking down the street with a television on their shoulder, right? I mean, we're we're talking about individuals who are holding jobs. We're talking about a wide gamut. We're talking about men and women.
Absolutely.
We're talking about mothers and fathers.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm thankful that that perception really is changing, because it holds people back from recognizing an addiction when it's sitting right next to them.
Yeah.
Because you can be an alcoholic and not be have a brown bag laying in the street, so to speak.
Right.
You know, talking
right
about that perception.
Right.
This is, you know, the day of train spotting, so to speak, is it's gone.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. It's college students, it's mothers, it's professionals.
Does that help you in the treatment?
You know, I'm very cautious in my interactions with people about like what I do, and I'm always very respectful of the treatment and my patients and their privacy. And I've had professionals I work with, now I'm taking care of their spouse, and I'm taking care of their son or their daughter, people who are in healthcare, people who are, you know, all walks of life.
Right.
So it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't discriminate at all.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that that speaks to, too, is for people to be aware that they, you know, that they're not isolated, too, for those individuals who think that they're too embarrassed to come forward, you know, that they can come forward. And we're going to be talking in a few minutes about that. I'm going to go to Dave, who has a question here. Dave, are you there?
Program. Yes, I am.
Hi. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. About 4 years ago, our son was addicted to heroin, and he was at a point where we felt he was ready to receive some help. He was 25 years old. He was not on our health insurance. And so I called the County of San Luis Obispo Health Department to find out what kind of treatment programs might be available for him, since we didn't have a lot of resources to pay for like a residential 28-day program, and was told there was really nothing available. So I walked into the Drug and Alcohol Services office in Atascadero and asked them the same question and was given the same answer. I called Hotline and was given the same answer. So at that time, there was really nothing available unless you had the money to pay out of pocket.
You were looking for inpatient?
Oh, I was looking for any kind of help, inpatient, outpatient, anything that my son could participate in when he didn't have the financial resources to pay for services, and there was nothing available. So my question would be, is there anything available 4 years later in this area for somebody that's on the street, that's addicted to heroin, that's decided they want to get help, and they don't have the money to pay for it? Or is it only a fee-based thing where you have to have money to get assistance?
Okay, it's a fair question, and I'll let the panel go ahead and answer that.
I'll go ahead and answer that. So it is different now, although, given the fact that there a need does not exist for inpatient care in this situation, so the detoxification program that we're talking about with the county is now $220 for the medications and then the services from there. And Katie can talk more specifically. The good thing under Affordable Care Act is that the benefits are extended to young adults, and the county now accepts private insurance as well as Medi-Cal for services, and all of its services are on sliding fee as well, with $5 a session. So those are good things that are happening, and you'll see a little bit more about that in the future.
I would just like to apologize that you were given that information. I don't know if we ever spoke, but it would be me that you would be speaking to. I filled all those detox calls, and I've run the program for a while. The beauty is, like Star was saying, as of this year, I think most people, now I'm no expert on the Medi-Cal system, that's for darn sure, but many, many, many people will be eligible for Medi-Cal health insurance, which we do accept as form of payment. We are accepting the private insurance. And the cost of Suboxone, sadly, is quite expensive. I certainly would love to be able to give it away to anybody that was in need. I really believe in this program. But the cost of even the medication is not even covered by our small fee. The program is approximately 3 to 6 or 7. I've had people on as long as 8 weeks. I try to give the best individualized care that I can. And I hope everybody gets signed up for Medi-Cal so that won't be a barrier anymore.
Dave, okay. Did that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. I know that we were absolutely desperate 4 years ago, and I mean, we had hit bottom. And yeah. I made every effort that I could think of to try to seek help for our son, and there was absolutely nothing available in this area at that time. And so I'm glad to hear that there is more available now than there was in the past. So okay. That's good news.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Dave. Bye-bye. Liz, did you have a comment or question?
I do. I'm very much appreciating what this other gentleman is saying. I also have a son who has been a heroin addict for 5 years and is clean now. You are saying it's a family disease, and that is so true. And beyond that, it is a huge social disease. We are a middle class Santa Barbara family with two working parents and three kids who have provided, you know, a good, stable life for our children. And unfortunately, these drugs are so readily available and so easy to get. Just within our circle, we've lost 5 young people.
Oh, my goodness.
To addiction. Beautiful, smart, funny, talented kids. From drug overdose. And my husband and I feel like it's often swept under the rug mm-hmm. because people don't want to discuss it. And I'm so glad the word's getting out there because it is even bigger than I think anybody is even stressing mm-hmm. on this program.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
huge.
Yeah.
And I'm also a labor and delivery nurse. So I see a lot of moms and babies. And again, it's just part of this huge community problem that goes beyond the family. Also, I do wish to make a comment that I think methadone treatment is very much controversial because mm-hmm. in some ways it's replacing one drug with another drug.
Yes.
And I know that when my son was put on methadone, he would just use it to manage his heroin addiction so that he could go to work. Mm-hmm. And then when he didn't, if he had the weekend or some time off, he could sell the methadone to get heroin. And that's a huge problem. And it's, so it doesn't cure the addiction and it's not addressing the problem. Mm-hmm. And many of the people who are on methadone just, you know, don't function well and sleep all day. And so I just wanted to put it out there. You know, I don't want to take away from any management or help people are getting, but I do want to at least make the comment that methadone treatment is controversial. I'd also like to make one more comment, if that's okay.
Sure. Go ahead.
That opiate addiction, drug addiction, and alcohol addiction has become part of big business in this country. And if the word is out that you're a family with someone who is addicted, you'll actually get solicited by various places throughout the country, you know, to
for rehab?
Pay thousands and thousands of dollars to have your loved one go there, and, you know, they promise many things. So okay. I do think that it's big business also, and so it would be nice if there was more available to people who don't have money. We have,
right.
Yeah, so okay. Just wanted to maybe address a few of those issues and,
well, thank
and
you
tell you that it's a very painful journey, and I sympathize with all those families out there who go through it, who are going through this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Liz.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you want to say anything, Dr. Starr, about what Liz was? I mean, it didn't come in as any surprise to you.
She was commenting about her experience and in the community. It is a public health epidemic.
Yeah.
In 2007, opiate deaths for the first time surpassed deaths from motor vehicle crashes in 2007. Mm-hmm. In 2010, there were over 425,000 ER visits.
Related to
involving non-medical use of opiates in
wow.
ERs. And there's approximately 15,000 deaths from prescription opiates a year in this country. And that's going up every year.
It's astounding. It's really astounding, and it's frightening. Frightening. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, streaming live at the web at kcbx.org. I've been talking with Dr. Ken Starr, Dr. Starr Graber, and Katie Dolezal about opiate use, addiction, and treatment from the perspective of professionals. We're going to switch gears here a little bit and bring in three more voices who will speak to us from a little bit of a personal perspective. And I want to introduce Eric, Jacob, and Mary, who are going to talk from the perspective of two individuals who've been on the side of using opiates, heroin, and from the perspective of a mom who's is currently involved with supporting a son who's working toward recovery. So I'm going to, Erica, I'm going to start with you. You've been working with Dr. Starr.
Yes.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about your situation.
You know, I started using painkillers, almost 10 years ago, and it started for a legitimate need. You know, I had back pain and not a lot of education on what I could do to manage that pain, and so started taking painkillers, and, you know, once every couple days, and then it slowly creeps up once a day, twice a day, five times a day. As many as you can take a day, and just been an ongoing battle, and it happens so quickly, and once you're caught in it, the addiction, it's just really hard to get out, and you don't feel like you can tell anybody because there's all these social stigmas associated with it, and being an addict, and what are people going to think, and not knowing where to go, and then slowly over time. But I was a high functioning addict. I work, I have a family. You know, which also contributes because now you're feeling alone and not really knowing what to do. And so that eventually led to heroin use because it was cheaper, it was easier to get. And then it just spiraled out of control for the most part. And I've been with Dr. Starr for a while. And for the first half of our relationship, I, you know, wasn't being honest with myself and, I had no support, and that was probably one of the biggest changes was having that support. So so now I'm working with that. My family knows, and my, you know, my wife, and so that's made a big difference this past year. So I have a year back on May 7th, you know, being clean and in recovery. So
congratulations
yeah.
for that. When you said you didn't have support before, was it because you were hiding the fact you were trying to go into recovery? Or
yeah. People knew I took pills, but I don't think they knew the extent. Mm-hmm. I would just kind of let people know bits and pieces. And, I nobody really knew. And so
you would not be the picture. I mean, sitting across from me, you would not be somebody that I would.
No.
Spot.
You
don't have a typical picture of someone who, I mean, you certainly, wouldn't fit a profile that I think would be a typical profile for people. So you could hide that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty – it made it pretty easy. And, you know, I come from a pretty – my parents are middle class, you know, really loving people. And same with my wife, very loving. And come, you know, a lot of addiction in my family with mm-hmm. either alcohol or other drugs. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I, like I said, don't feel like I fit the profile. I go to work every day, and but it's just – it's – it doesn't matter who you are or what you do. It can happen to anybody, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. so, yeah.
Good. And Jacob, you're a graduate of a program.
Indeed.
So you, I mean, you worked hard.
Very.
Yeah.
Very
and
hard.
You've been a graduate now how long?
I graduated on May 2nd.
Great.
So.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about you.
Well, my story is really very typical, I think, of the horror stories that you're told as a child of the dangers of drugs. I was certainly that kid that, you know, your parents say, don't touch the stove. I'm going to touch it because I need to, like, see for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in a very, very positive and functioning family. A lot of love, a lot of support. And drugs and alcohol were always off limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grew up in, with rather strict, guidelines. And I think that pushed me in the opposite direction. I had to test authority and I had to find out for myself why I was being told no to all of these things. You know, by the time I was 13, was regularly smoking marijuana. By the time I was 15, I was doing cocaine and pills. And I did have knee surgery due to an injury from skateboarding and was prescribed Norcos.
Mm-hmm.
And I instantly fell in love, you know.
With the feeling.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Even taking them as prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just this feeling of warmth and security that I had never felt up until that moment. That quickly escalated. And, you know, as we've heard on the show, it was very easy for me to manipulate and get my prescriptions refilled and to abuse them. You know, and I know it is a touchy subject, but personally for me, what I've seen is you know, the pharmaceutical industry is big business, and I think it's a revolving door both ways. I think treatment and the prison systems and the pharmaceutical companies are almost working together. You create a mother as an addict who creates, you know, and that's legal. Let's prescribe pills to mom that son gets into the medicine cabinet. You're giving money to the pharmaceutical companies. Then the son gets addicted to heroin because mom doesn't have any more pills. And that starts putting money back into the prison systems.
So it feels like it's a collusion to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and I could go off into a bunch of roads
when
on
did,
that. But
when did you decide to go into treatment or was that your decision?
This,
were you forced?
I was forced on multiple occasions.
Okay. I was going to say, it doesn't sound like from your history you came about this just kind of one day going, I think I'll try that.
It was, you know, multiple attempts from inpatient rehabilitations to outpatient rehabilitations to the methadone clinic, and nothing was working.
What was the longest time you stayed clean?
Never. You know,
I was using
every time I was in rehab. No matter what.
Okay. So you were gaming the whole time.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Really what did it for me was there was a moment where I was taking methadone basically to get through my day, work and function. But, you know, I had the amazing realization one day that I can still shoot up heroin even if I'm doing methadone. You know, they tell you at the clinic, oh, you're not going to be able to get high, which is a complete farce.
Just like the rules they told you before, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
You know?
Gotcha.
And so I found that very financially easy to balance because I was getting enough methadone to keep me well through the whole day to where I didn't have to spend as much money on the illicit drugs.
When did you get into the program with Katie?
Well, with Drug and Alcohol Services, I caught some charges, and I was facing a very lengthy prison sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I had a 3-year-old son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the first time ever I had the realization. My eyes were opened to I'm throwing away my life.
Is the mother of your son an addict?
She was as well, yes.
She clean?
Yes.
Okay.
Both of us actually were arrested. And she did very well in treatment. I did not do so well. We ended up having a falling out, which a lot of times due to depression, anxiety, and not knowing how to handle emotions as an addict, we will run right back to what we know makes us feel good, which is what happened in my case.
And you're getting a nod from Eric over there, who's going,
oh,
yeah, I get that.
Best excuse in the world.
Pain, hurt, you know. But yeah, so.
How long was your treatment program?
The treatment program that I did is scheduled to be 18 months. And I actually was in it for 32.
Okay.
And
did
that
you break a record? Or
I was trying to set one, apparently. But yeah, basically this is the first time I entered treatment semi-ready,
yeah.
I will say.
Got it.
More than anything, it was the fear of going to prison for 15 years and not being there to raise my son.
So if you screw up, do you go to prison?
Yes, I did have a joint suspension.
Okay. So you have some motivation still?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's good.
I think that initially was the biggest help, was the fear as a motivator.
Okay. So we've got two people, one who is facing motivation from outside and the other one that's facing motivation internally.
Yeah. Or, well, yeah.
Kinda.
My wife was going to leave me with my kids. Similar. Lose my kids, you know.
Okay.
And
so there is motivation for loss of something, whether it's freedom or family.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna turn to Mary here because you come from a different place on this. You come from having raised a son. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you discovered?
Yeah, I would like to. And I'd like to also comment that every story that I'm hearing is a part of my son's journey. And what Liz said, our caller Liz, we have the almost identical situation. My son came from a two-parent family, middle class, loving. We always were open and talking about drugs and usage. He started, as Jacob did, smoking pot when he was about seventh and eighth grade. Mm-hmm. He had a surgery. And at that time, we didn't know that he'd already been experimenting at the parties where they put the bowl out there and they're... Anyway, he was prescribed medication that I monitored, too. So that's what's really scary about that. I was aware enough to know that I wouldn't just leave that out for him. But he got it elsewhere. Because I was hiding it, he went elsewhere. And he gradually, it became too expensive, like you guys have all said, and he turned to heroin. This past February, we found out that he had been using heroin for 4 years, and he's a 21-year-old man. As a parent, there were signs. We always attributed it to something else.
Depression.
Depression. Mm-hmm. He got self-medicating. But I can look back now and see that what was happening. The lies Chris mentioned earlier about the families being torn apart. It's just been... very tragic and a lot of, like I say, a lot of lies, a lot of deceit. So he's currently in treatment. He's at an inpatient treatment. He relapsed. He was out for a month and he relapsed just 2 weeks ago, we found out. So he is back in. It's just been quite a journey. And my reason that I'm here when I was approached about this is because it's the education is not out there for San Luis Obispo County. We're all in denial.
Or that, Santa Barbara
and
County.
And Santa Barbara County, yes.
Yeah.
Just locally. And as I'm researching and educating myself, I'm finding that the statistics for our local community are extremely high compared to other same demographic cities. So this show's so important.
Okay. Thank you. So with what you want to get out, what helped you seek treatment? How would you encourage other people that are in a situation to seek treatment? I mean, where do they go? You've heard from callers that say, you know, there aren't resources, and yet we're hearing from two resources here that there's access here. How to get the word out?
I think a lot of it does have to come from an internal motivation. I think, as I was saying, you know, it is no longer a fear for me to continue in my sobriety and to stay clean. It is now something that I've learned to do for myself. And by bettering myself, I can better my entire family and the relationships I have with everyone. I think the most important thing to have known is support is vital. If you have a loved one, son, daughter, house or wife, whoever that approaches you or confides in you about their addiction and they are seeking treatment or help, it is just vital that you assist them in that process.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the things that, you know, were stumbling blocks for my parents were not having outlets or not being able to find places in which I could receive treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not the biggest advocate of any medication, period. But I think in some cases, when properly monitored, Suboxone at this point is probably the closest thing we have to helping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that clearly you're not going to get people willingly to go do this, but if you could just lock someone in a room for 30 days and let them sweat it out, sure. You know, the only reason I'm against the medication is just due to the fact that it can also cause its own dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But again,
what do you say, Eric?
I definitely agree with a lot of the stuff Jake was saying. You know, support is key. And as a mother, you know, my wife, my parents, I'm sure it's very hard to try to put yourself in that person's shoes and understand why, you know, and hard probably not to take it personal, especially with all the lies and the deceit. Because I know I would get mad if someone lied to me. I would be angry, and it would be hard to show empathy, you know, or sympathy, you know, because you're feeling hurt and violated. And, you know, definitely takes a certain person to be able to kind of push that aside. And so for your son, I think you're doing a great job, and that's awesome that you're, you know, you're there for him. My
parents was very sweet
been
of
there
you.
For me, so
yeah.
I don't know that I would. I don't think I could do it without the support. I just think someone mentioned it earlier. You just can't do it alone. It's really, really tough. But as far as treatment options, I think it's hard for people because you feel alone, because you feel stuck, because in some of these programs you have to put out money.
Right.
And it's $220. And while I'll go spend $220 on a sack of dope, that's probably what I would do if I had $220, you know.
Sure.
And I probably don't. I probably have $100. So for now, I'm going to go get high, and I'll maybe try tomorrow. And so it's very tough.
Yeah.
Then there's paperwork and you know, this red tape to jump through. And
right.
It's like, I don't have time for that. I'm feeling sick. I need to get high.
Yeah.
I can only focus
I'll
on
do
this
it
next
another
5
day.
Minutes, another day. And so it's just – and then the next day, well, I don't care about it, and you just get in this vicious cycle. And, you know, sometimes it takes things like being locked up, but I've been there too, and it didn't stop me. You know, it's different for everybody. I think a combination, you know, for me, I am on the medications, and it's helped me stay clean.
Mm-hmm.
I do recognize that it is another dependence.
Mm-hmm.
By far, it is not anywhere near as bad as
right.
You know, using heroin and the way it makes me feel. If I miss a dose, I'm not sick and just, oh gosh, you know, just feeling
right.
horrible. But I do think, you got it. Like you said, there's an internal drive, a feeling of wanting to get help. I don't think I've ever met a drug addict that didn't somewhere deep down want to get help and want to stop what they're doing. But it's harder to do that than it is to just give up and say, you know what, I'm just going to spend my money on drugs. I'm going to feel good for the next however long. It's easier to do that than it is to try and get help. So, yeah, but I think a combination of therapy is key.
Right.
We have bad habits. You know, we
right.
mentally, we psych ourselves out.
Yeah.
There's all these things. So
it's
having
not
that
just
combination,
getting clean. It's how to stay clean.
How to stay clean, right, mm-hmm. and changing, you know, the way you think about things. So yeah.
We have about 3 minutes okay. left in the show. And what I do want to do is, Dr. Starr, if you could let people know if they are interested in finding out about your program, how they can get more information, website, phone number.
Sure. So my clinic is in Los Osos, and the website is kenstarrmd.com, kenstarrmd.com, 232-24. But look in the website for the phone number. 242-1360.
So you can Google Ken Starr, and that's Starr with two R's.
Yeah, so we do outpatient treatment, detox support, counseling, recovery services for – oh, thank you, Eric. 242-1360, and we try to keep our fees, you know, we're the lowest cost and highest quality providers, really. We really try to keep it real. All the counselors are in recovery. It's a great program. It's a great vibe. We have tremendous success, and we're just really grateful to offer the services.
Thank you.
And
no. Okay. No. And Katie, do you want to give the phone number for reaching you?
I'm at County Drug and Alcohol Services. Our main number is 781-4753. That's 781-4753. And I have a very lengthy, I apologize, outgoing message regarding my program. Additionally, you can have pre-recorded information about particularly the Suboxone program. You can find on that outgoing message at 781-4728. That's 781-4728.
Great. And I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Ken Starr of Addiction Medicine Group. And you can find him. You can Google him, Dr. Starr. That's with two R's, MD, Addiction Medical Group. Dr. Starr Graber, Division Manager. And Katie Dorzal, who is the nurse practitioner for San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services. You can also Google for their report, for the County Drug and Alcohol Services report. I want to thank Eric and Jacob and Mary for joining me today. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. And there were a couple of callers who didn't get through today. If you can go ahead and send your questions to voices@kcbx.org, we'll make sure that they get routed through to Dr. Starr. To Starr Graber or to Katie. Next week on Voices, Central Coast Voices, Fred Monroe will be joined by guests Nicole Smith, Linda Chipping, and they're going to be talking about San Luis Resource Conservation District. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and I want to thank you for listening today. Again, if you did not hear the whole show, you can hear this on our website at kcbx.org.